You know, I got involved with the fight for single-payer health care when I actually had my own run-in with the healthcare system. I used to be involved. I was in school for labor education and labor research when I had a major medical incident that landed me in the hospital for a few days. And when I was being discharged, my doctor sat me down and said that my insurance company, which was Aetna at the time, was refusing to cover my stay in the hospital. Which didn't panic me until I actually saw the healthcare bill itself, which was a $5,000 bill, and at the time I was earning, you know, less than $14,000 a year, so it was might as well have been $5 million for me. It was going to bankrupt me. And so shortly after that, you know, I hadn't even realized that there was a social movement for single payer healthcare, when healthcare is a right. I had lived in England. I knew what it was like. I knew it was possible. But yeah, so after that horrifying run-in with the insurance industry, and, you know, I had the misfortune of being sick. I had insurance. I was just following my doctor's orders. I didn't admit myself to the hospital. But this is just how our healthcare system works. We have the only healthcare system in the world that's oriented towards avoiding care for the sick, which is all that we want our healthcare system to do. So that's how I first got involved. You know, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, it was based largely on the law that was passed in Massachusetts. They're very similar to each other. They're not identical, but the big pieces are pretty much the same. And it was passed by a Democratic legislature and signed into law by Mitt Romney, a Republican governor, obviously. And, you know, they're both similar in that there's a political compromise at the heart of those reform efforts, which is they attempt to expand access to care, which is a good thing. That's one of the major shortcomings of our healthcare system. It's not the only shortcoming of our healthcare system, but it's the one that leads to sort of the most morally outrageous and ethically outrageous outcomes of, you know, people dying due to lack of healthcare, people just not getting the care they need, and needless suffering. The other part of that compromise is that in exchange for expanding care, that there would be no cost control. And this is to buy off opposition from the healthcare industry. Obviously, all of the players in the healthcare industry want to expand access to care, because that means more income for them. Hospitals don't like treating uninsured people because they usually lose money. Pharmaceutical companies like covering more people because that means more customers for them. Same thing for just about everyone else in the healthcare industry. But when you talk about tackling the outrageous prices that come from those from the healthcare system that they're allowed to charge in the United States for pharmaceuticals, for everything, for, you know, medical devices, for hospital stays, for physician visits, and that's really at the core of why our healthcare system doesn't work, is that it costs so much and the costs are rising so quickly and people just can't afford those costs. That the political compromise is we're not going to do anything about that. We're essentially going to pay off the healthcare industry. We're going to pay them more money, and we're going to cover more people. So it's not a sustainable solution. It means that there's some positive impacts of both the Massachusetts law and the Affordable Care Act in terms of expanding care to some people. They were both inadequate. They didn't cover everyone. And as we've all seen, the crisis of uninsurance has been replaced to a significant extent with a larger crisis of underinsurance, where almost everyone is facing deductibles now and large copayments and coinsurance, and we're all starting to face these limited networks. So there's been an erosion of insurance across the board. So they're by far imperfect in terms of increasing access to care, but they've done really nothing to stop the crisis in cost that just makes our whole healthcare system unsustainable, and it's just devastating household budgets and business budgets, and it's eating away at government's ability to pay for anything else, since it's taking up the federal budget, it's taking up state budgets, municipal budgets. So it's really an economic crisis that's gone totally unaddressed by that model of reform.
Well, one of the best things about Bernie Sanders running is getting this conversation back into the public's awareness. Would you agree with that? And how do you, has that been a, what have you seen since Sanders has brought this into the public's consciousness in the last 6 to 9 months? I wonder what whether the conversation would be where it is today if he wasn't running.
Yeah, you know, it's been really a tremendously important election season for the issue of single payer health care. And you know, I have to tell you, we've been doing there's single payer activists and organizations in basically every state in the country. We've been doing significant outreach and organizing work for decades now, and it's paid off because going into this election cycle, before the Sanders campaign really took off, according to national polling, a strong majority of Americans support single payer health care, and that includes over 80% of Democrats, 60% of Independents, and even 30% of Republicans. So it's actually a miracle that we haven't had viable Democratic national presidential candidates fighting for single payer in the past, given that there's almost universal support for single payer among the Democratic Party. And we see the same thing at the state level. There's really a democracy gap going on where we have this vast, strong support for making healthcare a human right among the population, and very much so within the Democratic Party. But the elected leaders in the Democratic Party have not been strong advocates for single payer. So I think this election season has been momentous. It hasn't been, a huge change in terms of popular support for single payer. I think that's been constant. But it has been a huge stepping stone in terms of closing that democracy gap where we're starting to see pressure put on elected officials to actually represent the strong beliefs of the party base.
And I know that there's been a bill in Congress now for I think it's been many years, right? H.R. 676.
That's right. Yeah.
And is there an expanded and improved it's the expanded and improved Medicare for All Act. Could you briefly summarize that?
Sure. So there are right now, there's a bill in Congress that would establish single-payer health care, Medicare for All. John Conyers from Michigan is the lead sponsor of the bill, the longest-sitting Democrat in Congress. He actually is the only remaining member of Congress who voted for Medicare when it was first implemented. Very simply, it would cover everyone with comprehensive health care coverage, and it would pay for it through taxes instead of through healthcare premiums. And it would result in massive savings. Basically doing what every other country in the developed world is already doing right now and that what we should be doing. And it's called the Improved Medicare for All Bill as a reminder that we basically do have something close to a single-payer healthcare system already for seniors. And it is cheaper than private health insurance, and it provides better coverage, and seniors are happier with it than folks with private health insurance are. So we have a model already. It's not perfect. It has some holes in it, some gaps in coverage that need to be plugged. So just by improving Medicare and expanding it to everyone, it's already in America. We have an American model already for single-payer health care. We don't need to look to other countries. But it's the most simple of health care reforms. It turns out to be much cheaper to just cover everyone in the same pool than to have a very complex system with, thousands of insurers and lots of for-profit middlemen skimming off of the system.
I see that it would save $829 billion in its first year. Could you give us a sense of where that money is coming from?
Sure. So the way that it's actually counterintuitive. I mean, I remember when I was first learning about this, it didn't make any sense to me at all. You would think that in the United States, we spend so much money on healthcare per person that we basically spend about two times as much as the next highest spending country. So we're just like a ridiculous outlier in terms of healthcare costs. And in many countries, we spend about three times as much as what England pays for healthcare, for example. So you would think spending all that money that we would have better access to care, better healthcare outcomes, better quality of care, but we actually get none of that. We have very, very poor access to care. For those who can get care, our quality is good, but it's actually not better than, you know, countries like Canada who have universal healthcare systems. So the real question is, where does all that money go, right? If we're spending twice as much as Canada, but we're getting worse outcomes, where does that extra half of all of our healthcare dollars go towards? And sadly, the truth is that it goes mostly towards administrative waste and profiteering. So if you're a hospital in Canada, for example, they have a universal healthcare system, so all of the hospital's money funding comes from the government. And they get one check at the beginning of every month that's adequate to cover all their needs. They work within a budget. There's no paperwork. They don't have to fight with insurance companies. They just have to document that they're covering the population and providing excellent care. In the United States, a hospital has an army of billing department staff people whose only job is to fight with insurance companies to try and get their patients covered. Every insurance company has a different set of rules, a different set of things that they cover, different copayments, and each insurance company has multiple different policies, all of which have different rules. And insurers are trying to make money, so they can do that by denying claims, which some of them do up to 30% of claims. You know, one out of every three claims they'll deny, which is mind-boggling. And the result is that it just creates massive administrative waste. So when you look at the difference between us and Canada, for example, where we spend twice as much as Canada, about half of that difference is made up just by administrative spending, administrative costs, and waste. And, you know, bear in mind that all these for-profit healthcare companies also have to spend money on advertising to compete with other hospitals, with other insurance companies, with other pharmaceutical companies. And they also spend money on lobbying against our own interests. And they have high executive pay and all this other stuff. So there's lots of waste. None of this money is going towards actual providing health care to patients. And beyond that, there's just a lot of price gouging. So, you know, for-profit pharmaceutical companies are able to charge much more in the United States than they do for the same drugs in countries that have universal health care.
What I find interesting is that the VA, they work out an agreement with the prescription drug companies where they save, I guess the cost for medication through the VA is considerably, I don't know how many times less than through a regular person who's not on VA, or even someone who's on Medicare doesn't even get prescription drug coverage without having to purchase a plan and then paying much higher costs than what someone would have to do on VA. So isn't it quite obvious that they could work out the same benefits for seniors and the general population as a whole by working out an agreed payment structure with the prescription drug companies, just like VA does?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the way drugs are purchased right now in the United States. Drug companies are basically allowed to just charge whatever they want, and most payers don't have enough clout to negotiate with, you know, a large national pharmaceutical company. So even a big health insurance company in California is not big enough to negotiate with a large national pharmaceutical company in the United States that has, you know, operations in all 50 states. But the countries that have universal health care, they basically are able to negotiate a fair rate for prescription drug costs. And pharmaceutical companies do fine in, you know, European countries or other countries with universal health care. They make profits. They do well. But here in the United States, pharmaceutical companies make profits that are, you know, three times higher than the average profit rate for Fortune 500 companies. And they're making that off of government monopolies. Remember, this money is all coming from patents that the government gives pharmaceutical companies so that other companies aren't allowed to compete with them with a product. So there's no, this is not a case of market-based competition. This isn't capitalism. This is the government giving them, you know, sole rights to market something and then refusing to negotiate to require them to pay a fair price. So I think if we're giving these patents, then we should also have oversight over over the prices. But within our current healthcare system, we have no way of doing that.
Mm. You talk about Vermont, and after Vermont, could you go to Colorado? Because they have a ballot initiative coming up.
Yeah, so we have a number of states that are getting very close to passing, you know, single payer at the state level. And remember, this is how Canada got universal health care. One province did it first. It was Saskatchewan. And other provinces followed suit, and eventually there was a national bill, and a lot of folks think that that's probably how it's going to happen here in the United States. And if you look at the state of Congress today, you know, almost nothing is happening in Congress, much less universal health care. So, New York is also very close. So what happened in Vermont, they passed legislation which was designed to implement single-payer plan for Vermont, but over a period of years. So it was, you know, they were supposed to have a large grassroots participatory process, time to do economic studies to know exactly how much it would cost to do this, how to pay for it, with what taxes, how to prevent, you know, economic disruption, with large shifting of, you know, who pays for what. Make sure that folks were getting all the coverage that they needed, that, you know, no one was going to lose coverage. So they were trying to be careful, but it also created a long period of time for the opposition to mount, you know, a counter campaign to try and undermine it. And that's ultimately what happened. The governor, who had actually been a champion of this and ran on supporting this for two election seasons in a row, came out in December of last year, not this past December, but the December before that, in 2014, right after he was elected, actually. It was literally days after the election had closed. And in a totally surprise, incomprehensible announcement, said that he thought that the state legislature shouldn't go ahead with a single-payer plan that he himself had been championing. And, you know, the language he used was that it would cause too much economic disruption. He actually released a financing proposal, a way to pay for it, that would have saved money for Vermont. It would have cost less to do it than sticking with the private health insurance system that Vermont has. So it was very clear that he had a political about-face and that the opposition got to him. It had nothing to do with, you know, with this turning out to be too expensive to do, or, you know, being logistically not possible. I mean, every country in the world, developed world, does this. We can certainly do it ourselves. And Vermont is a small state, but it's just as big as plenty of small European countries as well. So it's a political fight, and there's a lot of money at stake. So it's not going to be easy in any state, but a lot of states are getting very, very close to winning.
Yeah, well, I just ran across an article last night in relationship to Colorado, and it said right now there's bipartisan support against it. It is a respected former governor, Democratic governor, who's well-respected, and I guess it was a Republican state legislator, and they've gotten together speaking out against it. So do you know what the obstacles are turning out to be in Colorado?
Yeah, well, I mean, you could boil it down to one obstacle, which is going to be money.
Yeah.
I mean, Colorado's going to be a little bit different from Vermont in that it's going to be a statewide ballot initiative. Colorado, this obviously was the first state to legalize marijuana, which they also did through the ballot initiative. So they're sort of taking, I mean, totally different issue, but they're taking the same tactic for implementing single-payer healthcare system there. It's a purple state. It's not the Deep South, but it's a relatively conservative state. It's a mix of Republicans and Democrats. But the Koch brothers are investing millions of dollars through their front groups in Colorado to oppose this. The Chamber of Commerce in Colorado, I believe, has already committed something like $14 million to oppose it. And money is just starting to rain from the sky to deluge the people of Colorado with misleading information about, you know, how this would lead to long waiting times and would, you know, put the government between you and your health care, and all sorts of myths that just simply aren't true if you know anything about single-payer health care real country. But yeah, I mean, there's they know that. I think that they know that the healthcare industry knows that if this happens in one state and it works, that they're going to be threatened in all of the other states. So wherever this happens, wherever a single payer gets close, money comes in from around the country to oppose it and to wage misleading ad campaigns, and it's very difficult to counteract those if you're a grassroots campaign and you don't have, you know, tens of millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, it's not too encouraging. Sounds like it's a bad as prospect as going through Congress in some ways.
Well, no, I think it is encouraging. I mean, yeah. I mean, we've reached the level of support among the population for single payer is really at a high level now, much higher than earlier years. It used to be that a majority of doctors were opposed to single payer healthcare, and only in recent years has that flipped. And a majority of doctors now support single-payer health care. And, you know, this didn't used to happen. It didn't used to be that state after state after state was approaching, you know, passing single-payer legislation. I mean, the state of New York just last year passed a single-payer bill through their assembly. That's their House of Representatives. And they're about, I don't know, a dozen votes short in the Senate. So they're also getting very close to winning in New York. So this is, I think it's starting. I mean, single payer is closer to winning than a lot of other, you know, major systemic reforms. So it's, I don't want to underplay how difficult it is to get past that finish line in any of these states. Many states are getting close, and I'm certain that we're going to win in one of them. So
I think of Bernie Sanders' campaign, and with over 2 million. People who have given and 6 million, uh-huh. I guess 6 million donations. Uh-huh. I think he's proven that that the average person can compete with the big boys money wise. So, if that's any indication, if you go into one state and the people get motivated and actually get out in the streets to educate and support the issue, uh-huh. that could make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been eye-opening. Just, I think a lot of times people feel hopeless about our political system, and that changes their priorities for what they invest time in. But any ray of hope that our political system will actually represent the people's interests can really ignite a movement. And I think that sort of those sort of changes are starting to shake both of the political parties. I think the demographic changes happening nationally are also changing the political calculations around issues like single-payer health care and other issues. So things, I think we're living in a time of change, and that's how we got Medicare and Medicaid back in the 1960s, along with many other important social policies. Things that looked impossible a year or two ago suddenly look inevitable. And so those are the political openings and the moments that we're building for as a movement.
Well, I just realized how I came across you. I was sitting here thinking, now how did I come across Benjamin Day with Healthcare Now? And mm-hmm. I realized it was through a piece that you had written that appeared on Common Dreams, the disappearance of Hillary Clinton's healthcare platform. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. It's been interesting because we've had a very intense primary season in the presidential election. That doesn't always happen. Sometimes primaries are sort of quiet or foregone conclusions, and the excitement really happens during the general election. It's almost been the opposite so far. And so we've had a lot of national, you know, so-called policy experts who have long histories of supporting single-payer health care, but who have become sort of affiliated with the Hillary Clinton campaign and have now become critical of Bernie Sanders and are adopting some of the critiques of single-payer that they themselves rejected just 2 or 3 years ago. It's been interesting. There's just been dozens and dozens and dozens of articles written arguing about the Sanders single-payer proposal. whether it's, you know, whether the math adds up for it, whether it would work, whether it would not work, on and on and on. And I think many of these folks, many of these middle-of-the-road folks have said they prefer Hillary Clinton's healthcare proposal, which is to incrementally build on the Affordable Care Act. But what my article pointed out was that basically none of them have actually looked at what Hillary Clinton's incremental proposals are, or whether they would work, or whether they would be politically feasible. And in fact, they're very vague. Some of the proposals that are unique to Clinton aren't fleshed out enough to evaluate whether they would work or not, whether they're fully feasible or anything like that. Whereas, you know, millions, hundreds of pounds of ink have been wasted writing on the Sanders single-payer proposal, which is basically what, you know, it's a version of what almost every country in the world does. So it's a very well-established policy. Whereas incremental reforms, I think we tend to think of them as easier and somehow more achievable, or that they will automatically achieve their own goals. But actually, a lot of these incremental reforms that are made within our healthcare system don't work because they're untried, and our healthcare system basically works against those sorts of things. Or you try and patch something up in one area of the healthcare system, and it creates another problem in the other end of the healthcare system. And so a lot of Clinton's incremental proposals really don't add up, or are not likely to work, or they're just too vague to even evaluate. But the entire national press corps has been focused exclusively on the single payer proposal from Sanders. So there's a, you know, there's definitely a double standard applied to these two candidates. And I was sort of calling on the media to actually look at, well, if you want to support an incremental approach as opposed to a systemic reform approach, you should at least analyze the incremental proposals and policies and see if they're going to work, because there's a long, long history in our country of, you know, passing incremental reforms that simply don't work incrementally. They don't incrementally increase access to care or incrementally control healthcare costs.
Well, the big thing is with the incremental changes, we know the insurance companies are going to be kept in place. So,
Fundamentally, you can't control healthcare costs without a single payer system. It's never been done. There's nowhere in the world where we have good access to care, you know, universal coverage, or cost control with a market-based health insurance system. There's nowhere in the world. There's just no reason to believe that we can achieve those goals, which I think both candidates want those goals. I think they're universally desirable outcomes. We want to cover everyone. We want to be able to control healthcare costs. But there is nowhere where that's been done without a single payer system. So it's just a fantasy to think that you can get there incrementally.
Could you speak about the film that you recommend people watch? It's on your website for free. The title is Fix It. And could you talk a bit about that and what a key role you feel that information can play in convincing or selling the idea to businesses around the country? After watching that film, I'm surprised more businesses are not standing in support of single payer right now.
Yeah, Fix It is this really interesting new film. It's available for free. You can get it for free online, or you can order it for very cheap from our website. We just basically charge the cost of shipping and handling. And Fix It was a movie that was created by the CEO of a company who is one of the nation's leading frame and mirror companies. And, you know, like virtually all businesses the size of this company, the CEO, Richard Master, was really struggling to provide adequate health care for his workers and to remain competitive. I mean, he's in the business of selling an actual physical product, which means that he's competing with companies from outside the country, you know, manufacturers from all over the place. So, you know, he was really feeling the pressure and trying to figure out what he could do to be an ethical employer. He obviously wants his workers to be covered, to be healthy and productive, but also to remain competitive as a business. And he just felt that there was there was no solution within our healthcare system, and the Affordable Care Act did very little to change that for businesses. So he decided to sort of investigate just the problem with the healthcare system, and as he did so, he commissioned a filmmaker to sort of pull together this film about how the healthcare system is so destructive for businesses. So this is, you know, this is a case that lots of us speak to from the perspective of patients, and we have a lot of folks who are providers, you know, nurses and doctors and social workers who speak about how the system doesn't work. But Fixit is really the most important new comprehensive overview and voice from the business community about how this healthcare system is so destructive to businesses. And I would really highly recommend it.
So do you have anything else that you'd like to say before we close, Ben? Because some information on your organization and what you would hope people would do if they're interested in obtaining single payer?
Sure. If anyone is interested in getting involved, our website is healthcarenow.org. That's healthcare is all one word, -now.org. And you can get involved just by, you know, clicking on the pledge button, or you don't have to pledge money, it's just pledging to support the movement. Or you can, you know, click on the action tab and sign up for email alerts. And, you know, we have local organizations in basically all over the country. There are people active around this. You know, clearly with the elections, the level of activity right now is at a high point. It's a great time to be talking to people about healthcare. So I'd really encourage folks to just sign up and to get involved. And, you know, we're happy to personally talk with anyone about what the best way to get involved would be, given people's interests and their skill sets.
Well, thank you very much, Ben. I really appreciate your being available today.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.